Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. In this hour of today's program, we will be talking firstly with Andrea Picciotti-Bear, who joins us every week to look at events in the nation and in the world in light of Catholic tradition, in light of viewing the world through Catholic morality. And we're going to keep talking about the Olympic opening ceremony, but we don't want to beat a dead horse. What we want to do is emphasize the aesthetic quality of the liturgical, sacramental, and theological tradition of the Church. It is providential that the opening ceremony occurred just days after this wondrous triumph that was the National Eucharistic Congress. We saw, without a doubt, one of the most beautiful celebrations of the substantial presence of Jesus Christ, not just nationally, but in the world. We, the Catholic Church here in the United States of America, traced a cross of Jesus Christ across this entire nation with his substantial presence in the Eucharist. Things will change. And even if we don't see them change immediately, the fact is, after so great a spiritual triumph, it's no wonder that those who have aligned themselves to the cause of evil want to make a similar public statement for the cause of evil. In the face of this, we have the beauty of our faith to not only share, but to live and to radiate the gospel of Jesus Christ. So Andrea will join us to speak about this. And then after that, on July the 29th in 1954, this was just about 70 years ago now, the Fellowship of the Ring was published. And as many of you who know me know, I'm an avid Tolkien fan for many reasons. We want to discuss not only the legacy of the Lord of the Rings and the Fellowship of the Ring, we also want to discuss the faith of Tolkien, and we'll be joined by Holly Ordway to speak about Tolkien's faith. And then toward the end, I'd like to talk about the abolition of men. Now, yes, I know C.S. Lewis's book is The Abolition of Man. The reason why I'm saying this is because just this past week, the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, said that abortion helps set men free. It makes men freer. And I just revolted at the idea. And we need to talk about this. Because the fact is, nothing sets man free except our liberation in the cross and sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And so we'll draw all of that to the reality of the fact that we are made for Christ, and to Christ we must return. All of this and more in this hour. For now, the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, July 31st. It's the Feast of St. Ignatius of Loyola. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Pope Francis is revealing his monthly prayer intention for August. Throughout the month, the Pope is inviting others to pray that political leaders be at the service of their own people. Francis says politics doesn't have a very good reputation. The prayer intention for July centered around the pastoral care of the sick. Former President Trump is questioning Vice President Kamala Harris's racial identity. Lisa Taylor has more.
In an appearance at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention in Chicago, Trump claimed he didn't know Harris was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black.
I've known her a long time indirectly, not directly very much, and she was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black.
Trump sat for a Q&A with black journalists where he touched on several issues and clashed with ABC News congressional correspondent Rachel Scott, who asked Trump why black voters would support the former president for a second term.
Harris, who got the support of the United Auto Workers Union today, is expected to announce her running mate soon. Harris will hold her first rally with her new vice presidential pick Tuesday in Philadelphia. The location suggests she could choose Philadelphia Governor Josh Shapiro. The Biden administration is announcing another round of student debt relief. The Department of Education says beginning tomorrow, it will start emailing borrowers who have at least one outstanding federal student loan to let them know about the potential upcoming relief. And Wall Street is closing higher, the S&P up over 1.5%, while the NASDAQ up over 2.5%. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. It seems providential that the Olympic opening ceremony occurred just days after the triumph of the National Eucharistic Congress. It presents an opportunity for you and I to actually talk about the beauty of our faith. Andrea Picciotti-Bear joins us. Andrea is a legal analyst for EWTN News, and she directs the Conscience Project, and you can follow her work on Twitter, at Bear Picciotti, and visit conscience-project.org. Andrea, great to speak with you again.
Thank you so much for having me on, Marcus.
So, you and your family, were you watching the opening ceremony last week?
You know, we aren't subscribers to any live streaming service. Mm-hmm. I basically don't know how to use my television, apparently. But we've been watching everything, the clips and the highlights. You know, just last night we were looking at Simone Biles and the great swimmers, Katie Ledecky. I mean, it's just an amazing feat to see all these athletes and a great opportunity to be patriotic for America. So I still am a fan of the Olympics. I think it's a wonderful chance to bring us all together. But it definitely, there was a big dark cloud that kind of hung over these Olympic Games as part of the opening ceremonies. But I don't think that it should be something that should stay forever. I think that there's a lot of light out there that we should be focusing our glance on as well.
Right. In fact, one of the things that my executive producer brought to my attention, which I should have expected would happen, and if I had thought about it, I realized it would. As soon as Friday happened, the Last Supper was skyrocketed, and probably in its entire internet history, in terms of being Googled. So people are looking at the painting. They're looking at the actual painting and realizing, gosh, that's proportionately more beautiful than anything we saw on TV.
No, and that's, you know, again, consistent. God will always take things that are difficult and turn them into something beautiful, whether it's our own human suffering or our own ignorance, or in this case, the terrible disgrace that was plaguing those ceremonies, those opening ceremonies. He's always able to pull something more beautiful out of it, and I think you're absolutely right. What a wonderful thing that people are pulling and looking at something that's so important to our faith, but also to salvation history, and that's the image that they're leaving with.
Right, absolutely. And I'm so glad that we as a global Catholic Church have rallied behind the fact that, yes, this is an act of sacrilege, and the proper Catholic response is, yes, make our voices heard. We have an obligation to not condone evil. But the bishops across the world have united in calling for acts of reparation. So they're calling us to penance, to prayer, to almsgiving, to fasting. Because what needs to happen is the world must return to the foot of the altar of Jesus Christ. And that seems to be the unified cry.
Amen. No, I was just reading kind of a statement from Cardinal Burke, the publisher Michael Warsaw of the National Catholic Register, president of EWTN, also talked about the importance. You know, as Catholics, we know that there's only one victim, our Lord Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. So our response should not be to fall into kind of victim ideology. Mm-hmm. We should call out offenses, but not be offended. Instead, take that offense and turn it both into reparation and into instruction. For a lot of people, they're poorly catechized if they were baptized in the first place, and to be able to bring them back to the importance of the Eucharist, to the sacrifice of our Lord on the cross, to the sacramental grace that can be found in the Eucharist in receiving our Lord under the Blessed Sacrament, and to the really wonderful consolation that can come in adoration. And you're absolutely right. You know, the enemy is trying to take away some of the great gains that were made at the National Eucharistic Congress. Mm-hmm. And especially as U.S. Catholics, we have to just keep powering ahead. We know that our Lord transforms everything into good. Mm-hmm. And so even though there was such kind of ugliness on display, France is a country that we should pray for. Yeah. A beautiful sister of the church, you know, a daughter of the church, and with great saints and martyrs. We should not write France off. but instead join our prayers for faithful Catholics there. I mean, think about the work that they have to do.
Yep, yep. And I echo all of this in my opening monologue earlier. I spoke about how this once eldest daughter of the church has turned her back on her father and her mother. And this willful, really the French Revolt became that catalytic moment, right? They've thrown out so many good babies with the bathwater that we, thankfully, here in the United States, because of the way our Constitution is thought out and formed, the way we have Judeo-Christian principles that undergird this nation, we have so much to be grateful for, that the faith here is thriving, it's growing.
No, I think you're right, Marcus. I mean, we need to be thankful for both the religious freedom that we experience as Catholics and that the evils of the French Revolution that took away the role of faith in society didn't infect American society to the same extent. But we also need to be a little street smart, too. You know, just last summer, there was a terrible offense for women religious of a drag group, again, that was performing at Dodger Stadium. I'm sure folks remember the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. This stuff is just ugly. And in many ways, it's so ridiculous and ludicrous that I think it almost helps our side kind of to point people towards what is good, true, and beautiful. There was nothing beautiful on display in little montage in France, but there was something really beautiful that went on in Indianapolis. And there's something really beautiful in the lives of religious sisters and priests and faithful Catholics living their lives out in their families or, you know, in the workplace, bringing their faith joyfully. Earlier today, I was at a prayer circle, and the woman that was leading it said, you know, we need to smile a lot. We can't forget the importance of being joyful and how attractive when we live our faith out that is. And that will draw other people to Christ through us.
Yeah, I completely agree. Lord, save us from sour-faced saints. I think that's Teresa of Avila. Now, I need to verify that my research is right. I did as much digging as I could, and apparently the Basilica of Sacré-Cœur in Paris has had perpetual Eucharistic adoration for over 140 years now, which means that even during the time of that public act of sacrilege, Eucharistic adoration was taking place. And that to me, especially you consider the rolling blackouts and the lighting up of Sacré-Cœur, that to me shows the sovereignty of Jesus Christ in the world. The fact is that, like you said, it's an ugly thing that happened. And the true beauty here is the returning to the substantial presence of Christ in his Eucharistic banquet.
No, absolutely. I can't agree with you more. And I think that we can find, you know, just driving around my own town, there are little tabernacles everywhere. And I think it's a call for all of us to pop in, make a visit, encourage in our own parishes to have greater times of adoration, and to see how that can transform ourselves, our families, our parish communities, our neighborhoods. And absolutely what we think right now we need and what we've always needed from the beginning is a transformation of the hearts and minds of all of the people on this earth. So it's wonderful. I think that, you know, these moments that shake us oftentimes are invitations to get us moving.
Right, exactly. And that's one thing that has happened, I would hope, that the global Catholic Church has in fact been mobilized to a reclamation of the fervor in our faith. Because one thing we do know is Catholics have made their voices heard on social media, in publications. We have not been silent about this travesty.
Yeah, no, and you know what? I've also heard non-Christians as well speaking out against this. And I think that's a good reminder that we don't just, you know, defend our own when there's an offense against our other Protestant brothers and sisters or even people of other faith traditions that interfere with the personal pursuit of a relationship with Christ. Obviously, we know as Catholics where the truth is, that the church contains and is a custodian of the truth. But we need to be defending the freedom of individuals to find God in their lives.
Andrea, always a joy to speak with you. I look forward to speaking with you next week.
That sounds great. Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you, Andrea. My guest has been Andrea Picciotti-Bear, legal analyst for EWTN News and director of the Conscience Project. Follow her work on Twitter @BearPicciotti and visit conscience-project.org. For Avi Maria in the Afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter. Stay tuned.
Every woman deserves specialized health care. At Arbor Women Health, our team of compassionate professionals listen to our patients and want to understand what they're going through. They serve everyone from teen girls to seniors. Our faith-based clinicians specialize in obstetrics, gynecology, fertility awareness and crisis, or unexpected pregnancies. Call 734-930-4020 or visit arborwomenhealth.org. Arbor Woman, faith-inspired, dignity-affirming healthcare.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Looking for a good book to read? Then check out the Epiphany Book Club, where Vanessa Denhagarmo and Jeff Kassab bring you a new book to discuss every third Friday of the month. Read the book during the month, and then call in and join the discussion on the Epiphany Book Club. The book for August is entitled On the Demonic by Archbishop Fulton Sheen, compiled and edited by Father Dave Tomaszicki. Get your copy today at AveMariaRadio.net.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart-friendly, ride-your-bike-everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort-style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The Fellowship of the Ring was published on July the 29th, 1954. We discuss its legacy in Tolkien's faith with Holly Ordway. Holly is the author, most recently, of Tolkien's Faith, a Spiritual Biography. It's a brilliant book. She's a Fellow of Faith and Culture at the Word on Fire Institute and Visiting Professor of Apologetics at Houston Christian University. You can follow her on Twitter at Holly Ordway. Holly, it is wonderful to speak with you. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be on. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I loved this book. I greatly appreciated the pains you went to building the spiritual milieu within which Tolkien was not only converted but also brought up. And I'd like to begin there. Tolkien started his journey not as a Catholic. He was converted rather young, but he acts as if he's a cradle Catholic, though.
Well, it's an interesting mix because he grew up his entire adult life, his entire boyhood, as a Catholic. So in that sense, he was steeped in the faith ever since his mother became a Catholic when mm-hmm. he was 8. But he was a very precocious boy. He had memories of being a child in the Church of England. And so he would have remembered a time when they went to an English-speaking church where they had different prayers, where the priest was married, and then he would have remembered the time when they stopped going there and they went to a church with Latin, which he later came to understand and speak fluently, but would have mm-hmm. been new to him, new prayers, new everything. And that's an experience that he remembered. He talked about it in later years, using the analogy of the Israelites going on the Exodus, that it was a journey through the desert to the Promised Land. So it stuck with him.
So I'm glad you mentioned Latin. I'm jumping ahead here. But the master linguist and philologist that he was, whenever he attended the Latin Mass, he would often do a little thing that was rather hilarious. And no one does that today. Would you like to share with our readers, with our listeners?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Oh, I apologize. He would have the missal in the Latin with him, never mind. We don't have to go down that path. Let's talk about the fact that his mother converted and she gave up a true livelihood. She had a whole community revolved around her work in the church. Her leaving that community also meant that she was foregoing the livelihood that she had, the community support that she had, and it was effectively lowering herself in the ranks of her social standing.
On his mother, for Mabel, I mean, primarily her, you know, she was a widow. And so when she, you know, she came back to England with her boys, because her two sons were born in South Africa. And they originally came to Birmingham, England, thinking that it was just a short visit while their father remained in South Africa. But he died there quite suddenly of typhoid. So she was a widow, and so becoming a Catholic a few years later, the huge impact that it had was primarily that both sides of the family, being Protestants, vehemently objected. And so she had been relying on family support to raise her two boys as a widow. And then with that support taken away, she really had nothing. And she was in effect homeschooling her boys at first, we would call it now. And then later trying to, you know, put them into a day school, King Edward's, which she had to pay for. And it was just financially very straitened. And so it was a courageous move for Mabel to, you know, basically go it alone with a tiny amount of money from her husband's investments that had been left to her. And this is one of the reasons why Tolkien in later years called his mother a martyr, because the family was pressuring her to recant her conversion. And in fact, her sister had become a Catholic along with her, and she did recant. She did, return to Anglicanism under the family pressure. So Mabel saw this was something she could do, but she chose not to, even though the poverty that the family experienced undoubtedly, exacerbated her diabetes, which at that time was, untreatable, unknown how to deal with it. But better rest, better diet, less stress would certainly have prolonged her life. And Tolkien really saw that her commitment, that she was not going to take the easy route. She was not going to get back into the good graces of the family by renouncing her Catholicism. And she lived that all the way to the end. And it made a great impression on him.
Right.
But I think, it's worth noting that he had this example, but he also could have reacted very differently. He could have been resentful of his mother. He could have said, why did she get us into this nonsense? And he had both sides of the family ready to welcome him back with open arms if he had renounced, his Catholicism and returned to the Anglicanism of his dead father. So I think it's important to recognize that Tolkien's commitment to being a Catholic was not simply an attachment to his mother. There was that element, to be sure, but he was intentional about it. He chose it. He knew that this was the true faith, and he committed himself to it.
Right. Her tragic death had a profound impact on Tolkien, and to some degree, I know you don't explicitly say this, but my read of it is that it influenced even his deep devotion to the Eucharist.
Well, I think the fact that, both his mother died and his father had died earlier when he was still a boy. I mean, by the time he was 12, in the year that he turned 12, he had lost both his parents. And I think that this gave him a very early and profound sense that we're all going to die. And death becomes a theme that he returns to again and again in his work. He calls it a theme, the major theme of The Lord of the Rings. And he says, in a very famous letter to one of his sons, that the Blessed Sacrament is the one great thing to love on earth.
Right.
And that's not because he didn't love his mother, not that he didn't love his wife and his children. Those were all powerful loves for him. But he knew firsthand that his mother had died, his best friends died in the war. He knew that they could be lost, they would be lost. And that, I do think, helped him to focus that there is one great thing to love on earth, and that is Christ and the Blessed Sacrament.
Yep, and he devoted, like you mentioned, his entire life to it, the one great thing to love on earth. Outside of his love for the Eucharist, he was also just deeply moved by the astonishing charity of Father Francis, who, by his own admission, became a second father to him in not just the demise of his mother, but, the early demise of his father as well.
Yes, and it's a beautiful story. Father Francis Morgan was one of the oratory fathers at the Birmingham Oratory. There was a whole community there, and they took Tolkien and his little brother under their wing. So he had lots of, you know, male role models and mentors, mm-hmm. which was very, very helpful to him. But Father Francis was special, first of all, because he was his legal guardian. Mabel had made him the boy's guardian in her will. And also that he went beyond just being a legal guardian. He genuinely cared for the boys as a second father. He spent a lot of his own money on paying their school fees and providing for them.
Mm-hmm.
This was hidden. He did this very quietly. He didn't make a big fuss about it, but he did it. And he continued supporting them long past the time when they, you know, were 21 and were no longer legally his care. And I think one of the most beautiful things about it is the way that he poured himself into helping Tolkien overcome the difficulties of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So consider, you know, he's an orphan, and both sides of his family are very angry that he and his brother are Catholics. He had to navigate that. Now, on the one hand, he could have just said, all right, John Ronald, we're just not going to talk to your extended family, safer that way.
Mm-hmm.
They want you to become a Protestant, and we know that that's not going to happen, so let's just keep you in the Catholic bubble. And Tolkien, as a boy, he was angry. He was angry with his extended family.
Mm.
He felt that, you know, with some reason, that they had abandoned his mother. For instance, his grandparents didn't come to the deathbed of his mother, even though she lay in a coma for days. He would have remembered that. So there was a lot of anger there, I suspect, a lot of resentment. And I think he said later that he learned forgiveness from Father Francis.
Mm-hmm.
He learned charity and forgiveness. That would be from teaching him how to have a relationship with the extended family, that he was able to restore those relationships.
Holly, it's such a joy to speak with you. We will continue this conversation on the other side of the break with Holly Ordway, author of the most recent Tolkien's Faith, a Spiritual Biography, fellow of Faith and Culture at the Word and Fire Institute. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu. Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Brought to you by the nonprofit Seton Home Study.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. You thinking about homeschooling? Seton Homeschooling, 40 years of experience, 17,000 current students, pre-K through high school. They provide the books, the lesson plan, the counselors, the grading services, the tests. That's right, pretty much everything. My wife and I use Seton. Some of our children. Tell you this, two of them got perfect ACT scores in verbal. And overall, the Seton students scored more than 100 points above average on the SAT. Over 30% higher on English and reading on the ACT. It's a rigorous program. You want to give the very best to your kids? Trust me on this one. Go with Seton. It is a beautifully rigorous academic program. Go to setonhome.org. That is setonhome.org.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at avemariaradio.net.
The history books tell of many times and places in which the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, decided that for the good of the state, some element of its population should be killed, like the Irish or African slaves or Jews or priests. While the Christian tradition maintains that human life is sacred, don't assume that the world agrees. Accordingly, many of the mothers, fathers, and grandparents bringing an unborn child to the abortuary know that they are killing a human being, yet have no problem with it, because history has taught them that human life is not sacred, and that occasionally certain members of society have to be sacrificed. Therefore, the pro-life movement cannot argue simply that human life is sacred. It must argue why it is sacred. The pro-life movement should show the world that as the person struggles with loneliness, runs from death, seeks answers, seeks beauty, the person is showing that he belongs to God. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest is Holly Ordway, author of, most recently, Tolkien's Faith, a Spiritual Autobiography. She's a fellow of Faith and Culture at the Word and Fire Institute and visiting professor of apologetics at Houston Christian University. Holly, we were talking earlier about the role Father Francis Morgan played in the life of Tolkien. One of the things we ought to also emphasize in that is that they did come to some conflict in Tolkien's adult life as it pertained to Edith.
Yes, because Tolkien, when he was still a teenager, and a relatively young teenager, fell in love with this girl who was a fellow orphan at the boarding house where Tolkien and his brother were lodgers. And she was a fellow orphan, but she was a Protestant, whereas obviously Tolkien was a Catholic. And interestingly, that in itself would not have been a problem necessarily, because it was reasonably common in that era for Catholics in the minority Catholic culture of England to have what they called mixed marriages with Protestants. It would have been something he could have talked about. Indeed, Father Francis's own parents were mixed marriage. His father was Protestant, his mother was Catholic. But the problem was that they started sneaking off to see each other and lying about it, which Father Francis, as you know, his spiritual father and his guardian, obviously took seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And that Tolkien started to, you know, not paying attention to his studies, and he failed his first scholarship examination to Oxford University. And Father Francis knew that he had a remarkable intellect in his ward.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that this was the place for him. And he wasn't just going to put him as a, you know, get him a job in an office somewhere. No, his adopted son had to be at Oxford, but to get there, he had to get a scholarship. Otherwise, Father Francis didn't have enough money to pay his way. So he says to Tolkien, "You can't see this girl. This is not working." And obviously that was very difficult, and he didn't entirely manage it at first, and Father Francis got very stern and said, "This is wicked. You must stop seeing her." The remarkable thing is that Tolkien obeyed. He said, "All right." He said later it was painful and difficult, but he accepted Father Francis' stipulation that not to see Edith, not to write to her, not to communicate with her, until he came of age, which was 3 or 4 years later. That's
mm-hmm.
a long stretch for a young man. Father Francis did allow him to write a long letter to her beforehand, so he wasn't being cruel about it, but he parted them, and Tolkien kept that rule even after he went off to Oxford and he was, you know, under, you know, out from under Father Francis' immediate guidance. He could have deceived his guardian and written to
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He didn't, because he loved and respected his guardian. And as difficult as it was, and it certainly did strain their relationship, I think he knew at heart that Father Francis was not being a, you know, a mean old priest washing young love. He was trying to raise up his foster son, you know, with moral health, telling the truth, and with getting him on the right road for his career. And of course, it turns out to be this amazing romantic story, because right at midnight after Tolkien turns 21, he's free of his obligation. He dashes off a letter to Edith and renews his offer to marry her. And she writes back and says she's engaged to another man.
Mm.
Oops. Tolkien goes out to see her, and he convinces her to break off an engagement, which was only because she was feeling like, how am I ever going to have a family if I don't marry somebody? Mm-hmm, maybe Tolkien doesn't love me anymore. And they end up getting engaged. They do end up getting married. She does become a Catholic, even though this wasn't absolutely necessary. And they end up having a challenging relationship, but a faithful, loving one for over 50 years.
Right.
And amazingly, he also patches up his strained relationship with Father Francis. Again, amazing charity and forgiveness on, I think, both sides. This could not have been an easy thing for either of them.
And a lot of that had to do with Father Francis's taking the onus of realizing that the separation he had from Tolkien owing to this meant that he as a father figure had to meet Tolkien halfway. And that's exactly what he did in trying to mend that gap.
Yes. And after, you know, after Tolkien turned 21, he could have said, oh, you know, I wish you well, young man, but that's it. But he took the effort. He even chaperoned Edith to Oxford so they could see each other, going out of his way to show, hey, it's all right. You know, it wasn't Edith I objected to. It was the situation. And they just spent time together, and he offered to celebrate their wedding. It turns out that they had already made their arrangements, but it was a generous gesture. And little by little, this gets repaired. And then by the time Tolkien and Edith have children of their own, Father Francis becomes a grandfather figure to the children. And how powerful, because they're both orphans. They don't have grandparents that they can bring to their children. But Father Francis goes on holiday with them. He becomes this, you know, lovable, you know, grandfatherly figure for the children. And I think the fact that Tolkien had experienced the power of forgiveness in his own life is part of the reason that he was able to bring this theme out so powerfully in his writings. Because forgiveness, pity, mercy, these are deep Christian themes in The Lord of the Rings. And they're so deep that we might miss them. We might go hunting for the more obvious, you know, Christian images. But
That's
really right at the heart of it, forgiveness and love. And he lived that.
You know, but Father Francis passed, years before Tolkien published The Hobbit. And you speculate, and I think very rightly, that final scene, Thorin Oakenshield's death and Bilbo's presence at his demise, it's gut-wrenching. I don't know a single person who reads that, it doesn't matter how tough a man you are, and not feel moved by the event. And it's like you posit, it's inspired by the life and the death of this man that he knew as father.
Yes, there's such an authenticity to that sense of love and of loss. And of course, the relationship he had with Father Francis was, you know, much longer and fuller and richer than what Bilbo had with Thorin in The Hobbit. But I think that's that emotional power, that sense of the beauty of forgiveness at the end when Thorin forgives Bilbo forgives Thorin for all that has gone kind of awry between them. And you just that fatherly son love, and it is it's so beautiful.
And so let's talk about the new Hobbit or the Fellowship of the Ring. The fact is, Tolkien, by his own admission, it wasn't accidentally Catholic at first, but explicit in the rewrite. He wove his notion of death, his understanding of the mortality of the human person, but divine providence amidst darkness, all of these things were woven into the narrative.
Absolutely. And that's the essential thing. I mean, he says this very famous quote that The Lord of the Rings is fundamentally religious and Catholic. But how is it fundamentally religious and Catholic? Well, unconsciously at first, and then, as you noted, consciously in the revision. But what he's conscious about is not putting in explicit references. Rather, he goes on to say that the religious element is absorbed into the story and the symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're right to look for the themes, not on the surface, but really at the deep level, like the workings of providence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is it that Gollum is there to bite off, you know, the ring and fall
That's
into
right.
the crack of doom? Well, that wasn't just a plot contrivance. I mean, it came about naturally, organically through the plot and the characters, because Tolkien is a gifted storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, on another level, it's the workings of Providence, because why is Gollum there? Because previously Frodo has shown mercy to him.
Yep.
He has not killed him when he had the chance, even though on a worldly level it would be prudent. Even Sam restrains himself and doesn't kill this wretched Gollum, even though it would be the sensible thing to do. Gollum's trying to kill them.
That's right.
And even further back, Bilbo chose to exercise mercy in escaping from the caves. He could have stabbed Gollum in the back and been rid of him, but he doesn't. So these characters have exerted mercy and pity, even at their own inconvenience or danger.
Yep.
And it's for that reason that Gollum is present, and for that reason that, because Frodo fails.
Yes,
this is something Tolkien is quite clear about. In the end, he has carried the ring for so long that his will has broken. He has passed beyond his capacity. And he can't do it, but providentially Gollum can do it for him because of this exercise of pity and mercy that has been unfolding.
Holly, I could continue this conversation for a long time with you, but we have to call it now. My guest has been Holly Ordway, author most recently of Tolkien's Faith, a Spiritual Biography. Do get a copy for yourself. She's a fellow of Faith and Culture at the Word and Fire Institute. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
How do we define sin? The Catholic Catechism defines it in detail, calling sin an offense against reason, truth, and right conscience, a failure in genuine love for God and neighbor, caused by a perverse attachment to certain goods. St. Augustine defines sin as an utterance, a deed, or a desire contrary to the eternal law. It is an offense against God. King David lamented, "Against you, and you alone, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight." We sin when we love ourselves even to contempt of God. The Catechism points out that sin in all its ugly forms is exercised against Christ during the Passion. Ironically, at this darkest hour, the light of Christ's sacrifice becomes the inexhaustible source for the forgiveness of sin. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
When families create daily rituals for playing together, they don't just prioritize creating a joyful family life, they're building a holy family life too. Playing board games and card games, having family movie nights, taking short walks or hikes, shooting hoop, playing catch, doing crafts, and other similar activities aren't just healthy ways families have fun. They're ways Catholic families can teach healthy attitudes toward play. In a world where fun is often equated with sinful or destructive behaviors, family play rituals help parents teach kids healthy, godly ways to enjoy themselves. That's one reason family rituals for playing together are such an important part of Catholic family life. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Location, location, location.
These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Mark Spita. The U.S. Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, some days ago, said that legal abortion makes men freer than they would be without it. Now, this is a small paraphrase, but this is essentially what he was saying, that legal abortion makes men free. It sets women free, it sets men free than they would be without it. I have to tell you, as a husband and father, when I read those words, I thought to myself, not only how shockingly heartbreaking, but just how childish, how absurd. One has to be insane to make such an offhandedly poor comment and poorly thought out statement. Growing evidence is actually proving that induced abortions cause significant emotional harm to the men involved in the abortion in one way or another. And unfortunately, not enough is being done to really assess the effect on men. In contemporary abortion practices, the discrimination is deliberate. Women are given the legal choice to choose and to opt for the abortion. Fathers absolutely do not possess any legal right. Legally, fathers are excluded from participating in the abortion decision. And before a woman decides to end the life of a child, there are a number of scenarios that involve male involvement. Sometimes the man is completely unaware. Sometimes he's aware but doesn't share how he feels, or he pressures. Sometimes the man pressures the woman to have an abortion, or he supports and encourages her decision to have the abortion, or he opposes the abortion and expresses his objections, but they fall on deaf ears. Or, as sometimes happens, he withdraws physically and emotionally, refusing to take responsibility for her or her choices. I have friends, Edmund Miller and Alicia Wong and Monica Miller, who share true stories of having seen every one of these scenarios play out. And in testimonies I've seen over the past 16 years, I've encountered men on different aspects of the spectrum. For many, their relationship with their partners end abruptly or deteriorate slowly because if they choose to remain together, they experience a relationship marked with a kind of silence about the death, and that leads to loss in intimacy, trust, and mutual sharing. And when these relationships end, the men are left feeling hurt, confused, they're unable to grasp what they've missed. And the research now shows that one of the strongest predictors of post-abortion psychological adjustment is, in fact, the support of a partner. As a father who has lost two children through miscarriages in the past, I can tell you that the grief of childlessness is a truly lonely experience for a man in a global society that only wants to focus on the well-being of the woman. Now, that's right. That's right. There's a fittingness to this. But we shouldn't ignore the fact that fathers who are involved in the lives of their brides and their children experience true grief at the loss of the child. There's a poem by T.S. Eliot that I am reminded of, and please humor me. We are the hollow men. We are the stuffed men. Our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quite meaningless. Remember us, if at all, not as lost. Violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. The USCCB actually notes that men do grieve after an abortion. They are likely to deny their grief, internalize it, channel it into something else. It's rare that they openly express it. Our culture discourages the expression of this grief for a lot of reasons. When men do express grief at an abortion, they are immediately silenced because it is a disparaging of the right of the woman to choose. And so it manifests itself in anger, aggressiveness, silence, lack of control, and essentially what the extreme liberal left would deem toxic masculinity. So men are forced to grieve an abortion in a private way. And because of this, they don't receive help, because their requests for help societally go unrecognized or unheeded by the vast majority of the societal framework. The research evidence is showing that they in fact grieve more than the mother, some parents.
especially if they were forced to endure the decision of the abortion. Men are more likely to feel despair after a pregnancy loss, including a pervasive sense of hopelessness, one of the signs of chronic grief. In fact, it's apparent that men's lives contain greater attachment and more profoundly affected by fatherhood than has usually been assumed, and we're thankful that this research is coming out. When I was growing up, there was a rap song that I used to listen to. This was in my late teens, and it touched my heart in a particular way as a late teen. I remember it even more so today as a father. It's called Happy Birthday by Flipside. It's about one of the rappers, the Piper. He now regrets the abortion he had of his first child, and he's seeking the forgiveness of this child. It's too painful for me to want to read out the lyrics of the song, but suffice to say that for as long as abortion has been going on, there have been fathers cut deep in the heart with the sheer intense realization of the loss of their child. This is the murder of their child. Something in them breaks. Something cuts deep. Something shows the emptiness. Something within them shatters. The other aspect to consider is that freedom at the cost of the willful slavery of another is not true freedom. So Buttigieg's whole male freedom comes at the cost of the woman's moral freedom. It creates a world where men are free to use women, and women are coerced into abortions most of them don't want. That's not authentic freedom, that's just domination by another name. That's bondage, that's subjugation, that's wrong. And our consciences ought to scream out how wrong this is. C.S. Lewis wrote in his work, The Abolition of Man, "The heart never takes the place of the head, but it can and should obey it." What we're seeing now is the result of a culture that has told us to follow your heart as if it means to follow your passions, and therein lies the problem. The mark of a man is not one who follows all the whims and ebbs and flows of his heart, but who has learned to temper his passions with virtue under a well-formed intellect and a will that chooses the good. So as a husband, all I want to do is to protect, to love, and to care for my bride. Nothing would ever prompt me to deny her the right of my protection and labor in her providence. As I mentioned, my friends Edmund Miller, Monica Miller, and Alicia Wong, they see women who experience this pressure from their men firsthand. Every day, more women come forward and talk about how they were pressured or coerced into unwanted abortions, often by their male partners. Where are the fathers? Where are the men standing up to protect and provide for their brides and their children? Regardless of its legal status, though, abortion represents an intentionally induced human death, and this will lead the soul to profound grief, guilt, shame, and trauma. It leaves a lasting impact on masculinity. It affects a man's heart. In fact, the studies are actually showing it affects his reproductive history. A father remains a father even if the child is unborn and deceased. I can attest to this. In the wake of an abortion, men face the choice of accepting this biological reality. They grieve the loss. They ought to seek forgiveness. Or they continue to deny their feelings and become emotionally disconnected. But regardless of the legal considerations, both partners have a moral responsibility in the pregnancy, and they ought to focus on the well-being of the child and the spouse with each other together. So when Pete Buttigieg says abortion makes men free, I don't know what balderdash he's peddling. But it's garbage. Again, C.S. Lewis in Abolition of Man wrote that we make men without chests, and we expect from them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. That's what's happened in society. That's the kind of manhood Pete Buttigieg is putting forth. And if we celebrate this, we do so to our societal and national ruin and peril. The Catechism tells us in paragraph 1731 that freedom is the power rooted in reason and will to act or not to act, to do this or that, and so to perform deliberate actions on one's own responsibility. By free will, one shapes one's own life. In other words, it doesn't matter how you and I try to deaden our conscience, moral responsibility catches up with our souls. The soul feels the sting of our decisions. And this is why the deeper we are in violation of the laws of God, the angrier and more hateful we become. So no, Pete and the hard-left liberal narrative is way off, especially in the understanding of the human person. Abortion doesn't free man, It binds both man and woman in deeper chains of sin, slavery, murder, self-destruction, and death. Pope Benedict XVI gives us the remedy, though. Only the person who entrusts himself totally to God finds true freedom, the great creative immensity of the freedom for the good. And that, my friends, is what freedom actually looks like. That's what you and I are made for. If you want to talk about a free man, a free and virtuous society enables man to live out a life of virtue, the freedom to constantly choose the good, to choose God, and to choose, in our case, the salvation of all souls. I want to thank you for joining me on today's program. I ask you to ponder on everything we've talked about. And as I mentioned earlier, we're looking at the 70th anniversary of the Fellowship of the Ring. So, you know, pick up the book, read it with your family, talk about the Catholic themes and Tolkien's Catholic faith. And most of all, continue to be a radiating light for the immense power and mystery of the Catholic faith. And the reason why is simple. Because in a culture that is peddling death and darkness, it is only the truth of the gospel in Jesus Christ that will set us free. We look at the events of last Friday, and it's easy to come up with a knee-jerk reaction. But it's the gospel of Jesus Christ that actually gives us the solution to this problem. Again, only the person who entrusts himself totally to God finds true freedom, the great creative immensity of the freedom of good. So let's take a look at our lives. Let's continue to ask, how are we bound in chains? How are we living virtuous excellence? How are we actually free? And for those of us who experience this wound, this particular wound, if abortion has touched our families, our lives in any way, the embrace of the Church is the healing embrace of the heart of Jesus Christ. Run to the sacraments. Run to the healing sacraments. And let the Eucharist of Jesus Christ bind up those wounds and set us free. Until tomorrow, for Ave Maria in the Afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter.